suddenly tight-lipped. For a long moment, Cardenas did not reply. At last she said, "Gobblers can be programmed to attack proteins, yes, or any carbon chain organics."
"That's pretty risky then, isn't it?" he asked.
Holly saw that Cardenas was struggling to keep her voice calm. "Once you're sealed inside the suit, the nanobugs can be sprayed over its outer surface. We can calculate how long it would take them to destroy any organics on the suit, double or triple that time. Then we douse the whole assembly in soft UV. That will deactivate the nanobugs."
"Deactivate?" Gaeta asked. "You mean, like, kill them?"
"They're machines, Manny," she said. "They're not alive. You can't kill them."
"But would they come back later and start chewing on organics again?"
"No. We'll wash them all off. And once they're deactivated, they don't revive. It's like breaking a motor or a child's toy. The pieces don't come back together again spontaneously." Gaeta nodded, but Holly thought he didn't look convinced.
The morning after. "What did you think of his speech last night?" Ilya Timoshenko looked up from his console in Goddard's navigation and control pod. There was very little actual work for them to do. The habitat was sailing through the solar system on a course that Isaac Newton could have calculated to a fine accuracy. The fusion engines were purring along smoothly, miniature man-made suns converting hydrogen ions into helium and driving the habitat along on the energy released. Bored, as usual, with the utterly routine nature of his duty shift, Timoshenko had been daydreaming about the possibilities of designing a fusion engine that converted helium into carbon and oxygen. After all, that's what the stars do when they run low on hydrogen. They burn the helium they've accumulated. The carbon and oxygen from helium fusion would be valuable resources in themselves, he realized. But Farabi, the pipsqueak navigator, wants to get me involved in politics, Timoshenko thought sourly. "What speech?" he muttered. The two men were alone on the bridge. Captain Nicholson had decided that there should be two of them in the control center at all times, despite the fact that the computer actually ran everything. "We humans are redundant here," Timoshenko often told himself. Yet the captain insisted, and her three underlings obeyed. "Eberle's speech," Farabi said. "Last night in the cafeteria, I thought I saw you there." "Not me," said Timoshenko. "You must have seen somebody else and thought it was me." "It was you. I saw you." Timoshenko glared at the man. Farabi claimed that he was an Arab from one of those desert lands that had once supplied the world with oil. He was small and wiry, his skin nut brown, his nose decidedly hooked. Timoshenko thought he was more likely a Jew from the ruins of Israel, hiding from the real Arabs. Timoshenko himself was as Russian as can be, only slightly taller than Farabi, but thick-bodied, muscular, with a heavy thatch of unruly auburn hair. It was politics that had gotten him exiled to this newfangled Siberia. His career in engineering, his coming marriage, his family ties that went all the way back to heroes of the Soviet Union, all wiped out because he couldn't keep his mouth shut once he started drinking. So they set him up with this woman who accused him of rape, and now he was on his way to Saturn, courtesy of the government and those pissant psalm singers who ran the government. "I wasn't there," he insisted, even though it was a lie. "I have no interest in politics." Farabi gave him a disbelieving look. "Have it your own way, then," he said softly. Timoshenko focused his attention on the glowing icons spread across the top of his console. "Why can't people behave as predictably as machines?" he asked himself. "Why can't people just do their jobs and leave me alone?" "I just thought," said Farabi, sitting at the next console, "that Eberle raised some good points. We should get involved in the management of the habitat. After all, it's our home, isn't it?" Wiping sweat from his forehead, Timoshenko bit back the reply that sprang to his lips. He wanted to say that this isn't a home, it's a prison. "No matter how comfortable it is, it's a prison, and I'm going to be locked inside it for the rest of my life, while you'll be free to go back to Earth after we reach Saturn. Instead, he said only, "I have no interest in politics." "Maybe you should become interested." "Politicians," he spat the word. "They're all alike. They want to be the boss and make you jump to their tune. I want nothing to do with them."
Nadia Wunderlei was one of the few people in the habitat who had followed Eberle's suggestion and changed her name. Her parents, staid New Hampshire dairy farmers, had christened her Jane, but she had always thought that the name was too ordinary to suit the adventure in her soul. All through her school years, she had been plagued with the plain Jane tag. She hated it, even though she had to admit when she looked into a mirror that she was indeed rather plain. Her figure tended toward the rotund unless she exercised mercilessly and dieted like a penitent monk. Her face was also round, although she thought her big gray eyes were attractive. Owl eyes, she thought, remembering that the goddess Athena was owl-eyed, too. Wunderlei was always trying new hairdos. Nothing seemed to help her straight mouse-brown hair. When she came aboard the habitat as part of the science team, she immediately dyed her hair brick red, gave herself the goal of losing 10 kilos by the time they reached Saturn, and changed her name to the smoky, exotic-sounding Nadia. As she watched the morning news vid replay of Eberle's speech, she wondered what the man was driving at. "We have a government, don't we?" she asked herself while spooning up her breakfast cereal and soy milk. "And we all know why we're going to Saturn, to study the planet and its moons and life forms, and most of all, its rings, those glorious, beautiful rings. This is a science mission. Doesn't Eberle understand that?" She dressed in the approved tunic and slacks and took one of the electrobikes standing in the racks at the entrance of her apartment building. Running late, she realized, so she let the bike's quiet little electric motor speed her along the winding path to the science offices up at the top of the hill. "I'll pedal home," she told herself all the way. "That'll recharge the battery and burn off some calories." Nadia said hello to everyone she passed as she hurried through the corridors to her workspace, which was nothing more than a cubicle, barely large enough to house a desk, chair, and some filing shelves. She saw Dr. Urbain hurrying by. He passed too quickly for her to catch his eye. "Later," she thought, "after I finish the proposal and it's ready to show him." She started working on the proposal. Urbain demanded a fully documented plan of research from each scientist on the staff. All the others were avid to study Titan and the organisms living there. They were competing with one another like grad students, trying to finagle a fellowship, which was fine as far as Nadia was concerned. She was interested in those blessed rings, and she had them all to herself. The rest of the staff were all slobbering over Titan, leaving the rings to her alone. "I can't miss," Nadia thought. "I'm the only one. I've got them all to myself." She pulled up the latest telescopic views of the rings and soon became completely engrossed in watching their mysterious, tantalizing dynamics. "How can they weave those strands?" she asked herself. "What makes those spokes appear and disappear like that? Above all, why does Saturn have such a glorious set of rings in the first place? They can't be very old. Their particles will fall into the planet in a matter of a few million years. How come they're sitting out there for us to see? How come we're so lucky? How come Jupiter and the other gas giants have teeny little dark rings that you can hardly see, while Saturn has this gorgeous set hanging around it? What makes Saturn so special?" Hours went by as she watched the rings in their convoluted, hypnotic ballet. She forgot about Eberle and his speech and everything in her endless fascination with Saturn's glowing, beckoning rings.
Oswaldo Yanez could think of nothing except Eberle's speech. He buttonholed other doctors in the infirmary. He stopped nurses on their rounds to ask their opinions. He chattered about the speech with each of the patients he saw that morning. As he tapped the chest of a construction mechanic who came in complaining of a strained back, Yanez spoke glowingly of Eberle's ideas. "The man is absolutely right," he insisted. "He's a genius. It takes real genius to cut through all the details and get to the heart of the situation."